Good evening, and welcome to Myelin, Movement, and the Mind, Hot Topics in MS Research. This webinar and tele-learning series is brought to you by CanDo MS and the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. My name is Laura Coyne, and I'm the Programs Manager for CanDo MS, and I will be your moderator this evening. CanDo MS is an innovative provider of lifestyle empowerment programs for people living with MS and their support partners. Through our programs, we empower people to manage their disease and move beyond their MS by adopting active and healthy lifestyle behaviors. Please visit the CanDo MS website, mscandu.org, to learn more about CanDo MS's online and nationwide in-person programs. CanDo MS is excited to partner with the National MS Society to bring you 50 webinars in 2016. The mission of the National MS Society is to help people affected by MS live their best lives as they stop MS in its tracks, restore what has been lost, and end MS forever. Explore the Society programs, services, resources, and connection opportunities at nationalmssociety.org. Before I introduce tonight's speakers, I would like to encourage you to be part of this interactive discussion. We will save about 10 to 15 minutes at the end of this webinar for questions and answers. If you do have a question, please post them in the chat feature located at the left of your computer screen. To submit a question, type in the small box that says Chat with Presenters. This presentation is being recorded and will be archived on the CanDo MS and the National MS Society websites. Because this is being recorded, all telephone lines have been muted. Our speakers this evening are Dr. John Schaefer, Dr. Megan Beyer, and Dr. Abby Hughes. Dr. Schaefer graduated from the University of Chicago Medical School and completed his neurology residency at the University of California, San Francisco. He has practiced neurology in Sacramento since 1978 with an interest in multiple sclerosis dating to that time. He is an MS-certified neurologist and practices with Mercy Medical Group in Sacramento, is director of Mercy MS Center and Mercy Achievement Center, and is on the clinical facility at the University of California, Davis Medical Center. Our next speaker is Dr. Megan Beyer. She is a rehabilitation psychologist and clinical researcher specializing in multiple sclerosis at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Dr. Beyer obtained her PhD from Yeshiva University. She also completed a two-year National Multiple Sclerosis Society-funded MS Rehabilitation Research Fellowship in the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Washington. Her research and clinical focus is the cognitive and emotional symptoms common to multiple sclerosis. Our final speaker this evening is Dr. Abby J. Hughes, a clinical psychologist trained in health psychology, neuropsychology, and rehabilitation psychology. She received her BS in psychology from Texas A&M University and her PhD in clinical psychology with an emphasis in clinical health psychology from the University of Kansas. She completed her predoctoral internship in neuropsychology at the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago, Illinois, and her postdoctoral fellowship in MS rehabilitation research at the University of Washington School of Medicine and Virginia Puget Sound Healthcare System. She is currently an assistant professor in the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Looking at our agenda this evening, we will begin with Dr. Schaefer, and he will discuss myelin repair and new developments in stem cell research. Dr. Beyer will then discuss movement and reasons to stay active when you have MS. We will wrap up our presentation with a discussion by Dr. Hughes on mindfulness and meditation treatment options. I would like to now turn the program over to Dr. Schaefer.
Thank you very much, Laura. I'm going to talk about a couple of topics this evening, myelin repair and stem cells, something that's exciting, I think, to everyone. Remarkable progress has been made in the last 25 years in treating relapsing, remitting multiple sclerosis. And currently, there's more than a dozen medications available, which in clinical trials have proven to reduce the risk of having another attack of MS, and there's increasing evidence that treatment early on with these medications reduces or delays the risk of developing those progressive forms of MS that tend to occur in later years. Unfortunately, this success with protective therapies has not been matched by treatments to reverse the impairment which has already been present or to arrest the progression of disability that occurs in the progressive forms of multiple sclerosis. To meet this need, research is expanding on several fronts, including remyelination and stem cell treatments. So let's talk about these issues. So here's a diagram of a nerve cell. You can see the arrow. This is the body of the nerve cell or the neuron, and then the long process is the axon, which passes along and then connects with another nerve cell along the chain. And in this way, the nerve signal gets from one level of, say, the surface of your brain down to the big toe, for example. And you'll see that wrapped around this nerve is the myelin. And myelin is like an insulating material that improves the conduction of the nerve cell. This is a depiction of the function of the myelin. So again, we're seeing the body of the axon, the axon itself, and then the axon processes that are connecting with the body of the next neuron. And here is a normal arrangement of the myelin. And the nerve signals kind of jump between these nodes or these spaces between the segments of myelin. Multiple sclerosis is a disorder in which the myelin sheath is damaged. The damage is done by the immune system. And in the second panel here, you can see that myelin has been stripped away. And when the myelin is lost, the nerve signal has a much greater difficulty traveling through that segment of the nerve and may not completely get through. And then what happens with time is that piece of the nerve fiber actually deteriorates and dies, or it degenerates. Here's another view showing the myelin and the axon in the middle, and this big thing is an oligodendrocyte. And this is the cell that manufactures the myelin that wraps around the axon. So the symptoms in multiple sclerosis are caused by the damage to the myelin or to the nerve cells, the axons themselves. And this damage occurs in the brain and in the spinal cord and in the optic nerves where this myelin lives. The damage to the myelin and axons is caused by certain types of cells and activities in the immune system. Here's a diagram that most of you have seen, I'm sure, that shows kind of the course of multiple sclerosis. The line here is it represents attacks of demyelination and attacks of symptoms. So here we are, have no symptoms, and then, for example, somebody wakes up one morning with blurring of vision in one eye, and then there's loss of vision that goes on for days or weeks and then gets better back to normal until another attack of, say, loss of feeling and mobility in the legs occurs, and then this may repeat. And then this is the point that we're talking about, that at a later point in time, usually 10 or 15 years later, there may be just a progressive loss, almost always involving the walking and may involve the cognitive functions as well. And this is what's been called a secondary progressive or progressive forms of multiple sclerosis. The arrows across the bottom indicate new attacks that show up on an MRI scan. And the dotted line is the total amount of of MS plaques. And the red line is actually the atrophy or the shrinkage of the brain. Everybody's brain shrinks over time, but in multiple sclerosis, it may be more rapid than in the general population. So if this is the issue then of losing the myelin makes the nerves not work so well, then the question is, can putting myelin back on these nerves create improvement in the function and restore the function that's been lost in multiple sclerosis? And that's really the key issue here. There have been a number of approaches to how would you put myelin back onto nerves that have been stripped of their myelin by the immune system. And one process that's actually under clinical trial right now is called anti-lingo antibody. Now, lingo is a molecule which prevents the growth of these oligodendrocytes and the myelin. And that's necessary in the body because if there weren't some breaks on the system, we would all be one big ball of myelin. And so the system has to know when to turn off the production. But one strategy would be if you could inactivate that molecule that's turning off the production, would it then allow myelin to grow more rapidly? And in fact, there is a clinical trial going on right now that's called the RENEW trial, in which this anti-lingo antibody is given to people who have an acute attack of optic neuritis, and then tests of vision are being monitored to see whether those people getting the anti-lingo antibody improve faster and more completely than those who have just the traditional treatment. Another approach has been Dr. Rodriguez at the Mayo Clinic has for almost 30 years now been working on another kind of antibody that makes myelin return to the nerve fiber. And then there are a number of drugs which are being looked at that that seem to improve myelin production. Our bodies do make new myelin when there's been damage to the myelin. It's just that they don't do a very good job of it. And so we're looking for things that that might improve the body's own ability to remake myelin. And there are a number of common medicines that are being used in experimental trials, antihistamines, for example, and even a seizure medicine, Dilantin, and also an antidepressant medicine, Prozac, are things that are being evaluated. Now, I might point out that these things are mainly being done in the test tube, and there's still a huge gap between our saying that one should run out and get any of these medicines and start taking it because we don't know whether it has the same effect in the human body, nor do we know what dose would be an appropriate dose to use. But I think it's exciting that that these advances are being made, and we're waiting to get more information about the these clinical trials. So let's then talk about stem cells. What is a stem cell? So every cell in your body starts out as a basic cell that is uncommitted. That is, it doesn't have any function yet. And then cells, as the body matures, get sent off to different parts of the body to perform different functions. So some cells will become blood cells, and other cells will become skin cells or liver cells or brain cells. And so of great interest has been the chance that we can introduce stem cells into the body, which can then go to areas of damage and become the cells that have been damaged. So how could stem cells help with multiple sclerosis? There are actually two ways in which stem cells are being explored in multiple sclerosis. The first is to replace the immune system, and the second is to repair the damage to the nervous system. Here's a very simplified diagram of what we believe is happening in the immune system in multiple sclerosis. And here on the left-hand side of the screen are these cells that are called T cells or T lymphocytes. These are cells that circulate in your body. The purpose of lymphocytes is to protect your body from stuff that doesn't belong there. For example, viruses or bacteria or dead cells or even cancer cells. And so these cells are sensitized in your bloodstream to recognize something that doesn't belong there. And then they get through this barrier. If this is the bloodstream here and this is the inside of the brain, these cells can work their way through that lining. And when they get in the brain, then they go and look for these things to which they've been sensitized. And we think that the attack on myelin is kind of a case of mistaken identity, where these T cells in the bloodstream have been taught to recognize something that looks like a piece of the myelin itself. And so then when they get into the brain and they see myelin, they cause damage. And all of these other little things are the weapons, the tools that the lymphocytes use. So one possibility of how to use stem cells would be to replace the immune system. So what we've just seen in the previous slide is that the immune system is what's causing the damage to the brain because it's been it's gone awry. It's received the wrong signal. So what if you just get rid of the whole immune system? Could you fix everything and make it work normally? And actually, replacing the immune system has been done for some kinds of cancers of the bone marrow and cancers of the bloodstream for a long time. So the way that the immune system is replaced is, first of all, to destroy the current immune system with radiation and with chemotherapy. So there's whole body radiation to kill off as much of the bone marrow and the lymph nodes as you can, and then you add some chemotherapy at the end to finish off whatever cells may have escaped from the radiation. Then you do a stem cell transplant. Hematopoietic stem cells means the stem cells that make the immune system, and then they grow and produce a whole new immune system, and one which presumably would not be intent on causing the damage. Now, problems with this. The one is that the side effects of this may be considerable. As you can imagine, radiating the entire body has side effects, and then chemotherapy has side effects. Another question is, what kind of hematopoietic stem cells should you use? One can get stem cells from the patient themselves to inject back into the patient themselves. That's called autologous stem cells. And then the other way would be to get those stem cells from somebody else, from a donor. Those are called allogeneic. The advantage of getting cells from the donor is that you know that you're giving a completely new immune system, whereas if you use the stem cells from the patient themselves, that maybe there's something about those stem cells that have already started to go awry. The problem with using someone else's stem cells, though, is that there's a whole issue of graft versus host problem, so that when you inject tissue from another person into your own body is very likely to fight that, and this may require lots of other treatment, including immune suppression. So currently, most of the studies are being done looking at using the body's own immune cells. The other problems with this is that doing this stem cell transplant of the immune system doesn't necessarily fix what's already been damaged. It, like the drugs we have, may reduce the chances of the immune system causing more problems. And this study of the immune system, or the stem cells, has been going on for a long time, and it's been slow because of a lot of regulation about stem cells. And ironically, in the years that it's been developed, we've seen the development of more and more drugs which have maybe even a better effect and are a lot easier to take, a lot less side effects. So there's still a great deal of research that's being done, though, with immune ablation and introducing stem cells to replace the immune system. The other possibility is stem cells to replace the damaged nervous system. So not cells to replace the immune system, but cells to actually go in and fix the myelin that's been damaged. And those oligodendrocytes that I showed you in that early slide, the cells that make the myelin, could we put in stem cells that would go to the site of the damage and become oligodendrocytes that would then make more myelin? Or could we make stem cells that would get into the brain and produce new nerve cells to replace those nerve cells that have been damaged? Or another scheme would be to put in stem cells not that recreate the myelin or the axons, but that would nourish and protect the myelin and the axons from their damage. So all of these things are conceptual and are under evaluation, but there's still a lot of questions to be answered. First of all, where do you get the stem cells? Mesenchymal stem cells refers to cells that can be gotten from the body's own tissues, for example, fat cells, or that can be redirected to be deprogrammed, you might say, so they go back to becoming a stem cell. Embryonic stem cells are stem cells that are taken from embryos, cells that truly have not begun to develop yet. And then other sorts of cells that can be induced, or a variety of ways of making the stem cells. Then if you have the source of stem cells, where do you put them? Do you inject them into the bloodstream and think that they're going to find their way to the damaged place? Would you inject them into the spinal fluid and with the same thing, expect that they're going to travel and find the place that they're needed? And there's actually some trials right now, a very, very small scale, of actually injecting these stem cells into the brain. Or at least I should say that there are preliminary plans for doing this. The point there will be that these stem cells will be injected into various selected areas around the brain where they're maybe most likely to do this repair damage, this repair process. And then the problem is, how do you get the stem cells to do what you want them to do? Even if you can put them in and get them to go to the right place, how do you direct them to perform their magic once they get to the designated place? Stem cell science is exciting, and it may bring many new options for treatment. The immune ablation and reconstitution is in clinical trials right now, has been actually for quite a while, and these are being done at a few very prominent medical centers and are very well controlled and are being done very well. Stem cell replacement of the injured cells is still a long way off. I want to stress that the experts who are doing this research at very prominent centers warn that it should be done only in clinical trials. So, you know, there are lots of compelling advertisements, for example, on the internet about stem cell treatment being available for MS. But the caution there is that there may be pieces of this whole chain that I've described that are possible to do, but to get the whole chain completed and to get that cell to actually go to the right place and do what you want it to do is still a lot of questions about that, and I think we have a ways to go on that. So I think that clearly the spotlight now has shifted from treating relapsing remitting MS, which has become very possible with our current treatments, to how do we fix the broken cells that are what we think are going on in progressive MS, and how do we reverse the damage that's already been done. So with that, I'd like to turn it back to you, Laura, for the next section. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schaefer. At this time, I would like to introduce Dr. Beyer and turn the meeting over to her.
Great. Thanks so much, Laura. Welcome, everyone, and thank you so much. And thank you, Dr. Schaefer. That was very interesting and lots of great information. So I'm going to transition us a little bit to talking more about some behavioral things that you can do in your day-to-day life. So I'm going to be talking about exercise and getting a little bit more active. I liked these two quotes because I think they really say a lot about exercise and physical activity. The first one is from the centers, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that says regular physical activity is one of the most important things you can do for your health. A little bit more specifically is this quote by an epidemiologist that said, the single thing that comes close to a magic bullet in terms of its strong and universal benefits is exercise. So, you know, while we're, you know, still a lot of people are still kind of waiting for some of these disease-modifying medications and medicine to catch up. Exercise might be one area that we can all work on to do to have a little bit more benefit. So recent research has suggested that individuals with MS are more sedentary than their peers, which probably shouldn't surprise many of us, given that many people with MS have increased difficulty with mobility. The downside to this, or one possible consequence, is that reduced mobility and, you know, consequently, more sedentary behavior may be adding to other types of disease conditions on top of MS, such as cardiovascular disease. So, and along with reduced mobility, individuals with MS have a number of what we call secondary symptoms, and I've listed a few of them here. So, cognitive dysfunction, so up to 65% of people will experience some form of cognitive dysfunction. Acute and chronic pain, fatigue, some studies show over 90% of people experience fatigue with MS. Anxiety or worry, up to 40% of people. Difficulties with sleep, Half of people with MS will experience difficulties with sleep. Over 50% of people will experience some form of depression over the course of their lifetime. And up to 75% of people experience difficulties with sexual functioning. A lot of the recent research has shown that exercise has been shown to positively impact every single one of these symptoms, including mobility. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the benefits of exercise. I don't think this should come as a surprise to any of us. We all know, we all go to the doctor and they tell us we should be more active. Exercise is good for all of us. But a few of the benefits, and this is not an exhaustive list, are improved quality of life, weight loss, stronger bones, stronger muscles, reduced risk of cardiovascular disease or heart disease or stroke, type 2 diabetes, reduced impact of metabolic syndrome, reduced risk of cancer, some types of cancers, improvement in balance and reduction in falls, better mood, that includes both depression and anxiety, better sleep, more energy, less fatigue, improved sexual functioning, I don't know if a lot of people know that, and also improved cognition and longer life. So there's tons of benefits to exercise. We could talk about any one of these for an entire hour, so I'm just going to touch on a few of them and show a little bit about what's been done in MS. So I'm going to first start with stronger bones, stronger muscles. Up to 85% of people with MS will report to their physicians or overall that they have reduced mobility as a factor of the disease, and that this is a major limitation in their day-to-day life. In 2013, there was a review article that looked over 54 different studies that were done in multiple sclerosis, and they found that moderate exercise 2 times per week improved both aerobic functioning as well as increased muscle strength. They also found that walking improved by 19%. And in people who had a trainer or somebody who was looking over their exercise regimen, like a physical therapist, their walking improved by 32%. Falls, as I mentioned earlier, are also a significant concern for many people with MS. More than 50% of people with MS will fall, some research shows that fall rates range from about 2 falls per year per individual or sometimes up to as many as 18 to 20 falls per individual per year. And every exercise regimen that they looked at was found to improve falls, meaning that people were falling less often and improved their balance. However, when they looked at these different exercise regimens a little bit closer, they found that focusing on balance and strength seemed to work the best. And a little plug here for physical therapy, there's a lot of different factors, a lot of different systems that can impact balance, including your visual system, cognition, balance, strength. There's a lot of different things that go into falls. And so having a physical therapist on board or somebody that can assess you may help you exercise in a way that's a bit more specific to your needs. So as a psychologist, I have to hit on mood. So I'm going to next talk about how exercise can improve mood. So up to 50% of people with MS experience depression. The National MS Society is now talking about depression as not just a consequence of MS, but actually maybe a symptom of MS. So it's something that really should be looked at and assessed and talked about with your physicians. But the main point on this slide that I really wanted to drive home was there was a study that was done that looked at one episode of exercise that was 20 minutes. So 20 minutes of walking or 20 minutes of yoga. So this is not multiple episodes. This is one episode of walking or yoga. The individuals who were involved in this trial reported immediate improvements in their mood and immediate improvements in fatigue. So even just one exercise session can help, although more is always better. So they also found, there's also some other studies that found that progressive strength training improved depression after 12 weeks, and that aerobic exercise for 40 minutes, three times per week, was associated with reduced depression. In terms of anxiety, anxiety is kind of a building area in MS. There hasn't been a lot of research on anxiety or worry. So the research I turned to here was really looking among patients with other types of chronic illness. And what they found was that other patients that had chronic illness or a chronic medical condition, any type of exercise reduced anxiety. The greatest reduction was seen for people who stayed engaged in an exercise program for 12 weeks and exercised for about 30 minutes for each of their sessions. And finally, since cognition is also an area of interest for me, I just wanted to highlight how exercise has been associated with improved cognition, specifically executive functioning. So executive functioning is what I like to call the CEO of your brain. It tells everything else what to do and when to do it. It's planning, organizing, doing things that take multiple steps, switching, multitasking. So it's sort of the area of the brain that tells everything else what to do and when to do it. This is actually a study that was done by myself and a few other colleagues at the University of Washington. For this study, individuals were enrolled in an exercise trial, a telephone-based exercise intervention. So they were called by an individual to help them keep motivated to engage in exercise. The individuals who were involved could pick any type of exercise, stretching, walking, yoga, running, swimming, anything that they wanted to do, anything that that was interesting to them, they were able to choose. Then we took these individuals and we separated them by people who had physically improved, so they improved their endurance, their strength, or both, over a 12-week period, or individuals who did not improve in their physical fitness. Those people that improved in their physical fitness also showed an improvement in executive functioning by the end of the 12 weeks. So what we're showing here is that exercise is also potentially helpful for improving cognitive dysfunction. Now, a lot of you might be asking, what about heat sensitivity? This is a real important factor for individuals with MS. We know that a lot of people with MS experience heat sensitivity or a temporary increase in symptoms when they're either exposed to heat by walking out in the heat or their body temperature rises. So there was a study that was done that looked at individuals who were sensitive to heat and the type of exercise that might be most beneficial. So the black dots here show individuals who were involved in aerobic or endurance exercise. They were tested, their core body temperature was tested before exercise, during exercise, after exercise, during rest, and then an hour later. This second line down here is individuals who were involved in strength training. And again, their core body temperature was tested before exercise, after, and during rest, and an hour later. And what this study demonstrated is that strength training might be a bit of a better option for people who are especially sensitive to heat because their core body temperature came down a lot quicker, almost down to baseline within 1 hour of exercise. So how to get involved. So the next couple of slides are really just, I hope I've convinced you at least a little bit that exercise might be beneficial. So I want to focus on what are some ways to get involved. I touched on physical therapy a little bit earlier. I think this is a great option, even if you go for a one-time assessment to have them give you an exercise program that you can do from home. Physical therapy is going to help you really specify your area of need and really give you some ideas for your potential concerns. So if balance is a concern, they can give you specific exercises. If you want to just get healthy, they can give you some other options. If you have some heat sensitivity, they might also be able to give you some options there as well. And I apologize for my typo here that was supposed to say movement, not moo. So another option is walking. So any kind of walking, walking outside, walking on a treadmill. There was a few studies that looked at individuals with MS and walking on a treadmill, and what they found was that if they walked on an uphill or a downhill grade, that might help to improve balance and gait. So walking, even just 20 minutes of walking can be a really great option. These are some a number of different websites that have exercises that are either geared towards individuals with MS or geared towards individuals that might have more mobility concerns. So I think there's a lot of great videos here. The National MS Society has some PDF pamphlets that you can download with both stretching exercises and some other options as well. This is by no means an exhaustive list, but there's at least a few places you can start for some at-home exercise programs. The National MS Society also has listings with many of the local chapters for professionals that have taken a training or fitness class geared towards helping them to work with people with MS. So this is from my local chapter in Maryland, the D.C. Maryland Baltimore chapter, and there's a number of different organizations or individuals who've been trained to work with people with MS or might have specific classes, and it's organized by county. So contact your local chapter or do a search on the National MS Society website, and you can find some fitness classes that might be helpful or geared towards people with MS. Again, this if heat sensitivity is a concern for you, there's a lot of great options for swimming. So the Multiple Sclerosis Association of America has a great online resource for how to get involved in aquatic exercises. There's a lot of great courses or classes that can be done at the Y or through the local MS Society chapters. So aquatic exercises are a really great option for individuals that have concerns about heat sensitivity. And cycling is also a really great option. There's been a number of different studies looking at tandem cycling in individuals with Parkinson's disease. And there's been a few that are branching out to individuals with MS. And we're finding that tandem cycling can improve things like balance, strength, endurance, and it's fun because you have a partner there. If you have mobility concerns, hand cycling might be an option. There's pretty much, if you're interested in cycling, there's a bike out there for you. So that is the close of my talk, and I'll hand it back over to Laura and move on to Abby.
Thank you so much, Dr. Beyer. At this time, I would like to introduce Dr. Hughes and turn the meeting over to her.
Yes, thank you so much for having me, and welcome to everyone on the line. I will be talking about using mindfulness in multiple sclerosis. Mindfulness has become quite popular within our culture right now, in Western culture, despite being about 2,500 years old, from more Eastern practices. It's taken particular traction within the MS literature recently. And so today, I will be speaking about an overview of what mindfulness is, what some of the benefits of mindfulness are for people with MS, and what some of the common mindfulness-based treatments are. These things include mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, mindful movement therapy. And with time at the end, given that we will be coming to close of this webinar, I thought it might be helpful to practice two different mindfulness exercises for you to take home with you this evening and really practice on your own as much as you would like in the coming weeks. You can practice these exercises on your own. You don't necessarily need a psychologist or a mindfulness expert to do the exercises with you. So I would encourage you to do that, and I hope that you enjoy the practical aspect of this webinar toward the end as well before we get into some questions. In a brief history of mindfulness, I do want to point out that the practice of mindfulness does date back over 2,500 years to ancient Hindu, Tao, and Buddhist practices. We also see many examples of mindfulness found in Christian, Jewish, and Muslim practices as well. So while it's founded in these religious organizations, because it spans many of these religions and spirituality and beliefs, there's a common theme of a focus on general breathing, calmness, and presence of mind that do tend to permeate throughout each of these religions and spiritual practices. Then there was a gap in our knowledge of mindfulness, or at least of the practice of mindfulness, and it really received its renaissance beginning in the 1970s as it applied to clinical psychology and psychiatry practices. In the 1970s, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's been credited with this resurgence of mindfulness, he founded the mindfulness-based stress reduction therapies in 1979, which we now are using today, and these therapies are now being tested in multiple sclerosis and other chronically ill populations as well. Interestingly, Jon Kabat-Zinn was trained as a molecular biologist, and his main interest was in this connection between the body and the mind and how the mind can be used to treat some of the bodily sensations and uncomfortable physical sensations that we have on a day-to-day basis. So what is mindfulness? We often hear the term, but we don't really know what it is. And sometimes we confuse the term mindfulness with some other common practices like hypnosis or meditation, for example. Mindfulness in the very general sense of the term is awareness, or paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. So I do want to take a little bit of time to focus on each aspect of that definition. So it's paying attention in a particular way. So not just looking at something, turning your vision to a particular object, but it's something that you're doing very purposefully and with a focus on the present moment. So getting away from ruminating about the past or worrying about the future. And then this element of being non-judgmental is such a crucial part of mindfulness, and that often we have automatic thoughts that pop up when we do focus our attention on something. And sometimes those automatic thoughts have a judgmental aspect. So we label something as good versus bad. And in the spirit of mindfulness, we really look toward this attention and this awareness with a non-judgmental eye. Other definitions that have been popular or commonly used are bringing one's attention to the present experience on a moment-to-moment basis, moment-by-moment awareness, or a gentle effort to be continuously present with experience. You can see how each of these definitions do tend to overlap, and they come with this common theme of awareness in the present moment. Mindfulness is also said to have two main components. There's the self-regulation of attention, so again, focusing your attention on the present experience with an emphasis on observation, so just observing your surroundings, using all of your senses to observe what's going on around you. And then the second component is approaching the present moment with this curiosity, openness, and acceptance. So that harkens back to the non-judgmental aspect of mindfulness. It's an emphasis on allowing your mind to wander rather than trying to control it in a particular state. So keep in mind those two components, especially when we start to do our exercise together, is that there's this observational component while also having an openness and curiosity. Fortunately, in multiple sclerosis, there's been a surge of research probably in the past five to 10 years, but really the past 5 years, of looking at the benefits of mindfulness in MS. There's been many more studies in other health populations, for example, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, high blood pressure, and just other negative health states, where mindfulness has been shown to be effective with these populations. But only recently has the attention turned more toward MS. And there was a wonderful review that came out in 2014 by Simpson and colleagues that really reviews the quality of the research that has been done, what else still needs to be examined with regard to mindfulness, you know, what do we not know yet, and where the research is going in the future. I believe that there's some interest within the National MS Society as well to continue investigating this. So if you do go to the CanDo MS website or the National MS Society websites, there are other resources for learning more about mindfulness and educating yourself, reading some of the other studies that have been conducted. But based on the review that was done in 2014 of the existing studies, which there's about a dozen or so studies that have been conducted thus far, we see significant physical health benefits of daily mindfulness practice, including improvements in standing balance, reductions in bodily pain, and reductions in fatigue. Importantly, and probably even more so than the physical health benefits, we see the mental health benefits. So this ties into a lot of what Dr. Beyer was talking about earlier, with the prevalence of depression being approximately 50% in people with MS. Mindfulness could be a very effective intervention for treating depression. Similarly, for reductions in anxiety. As a psychologist, I often incorporate mindfulness exercises into my work with patients with a variety of needs, whether it's depression, anxiety, just overall coping with stress, you know, normal life stressors that do pop up from time to time. And probably above all of the benefits, we see quality of life improving with continued mindfulness practice. So you may not even be able to change much about your physical abilities, but how you view your physical abilities and how you're able to incorporate other abilities into your daily life can be improved with mindfulness that then supports this overall improvement in quality of life. So in these studies, we've seen improvements in overall well-being and improvements in health-related quality of life. So people are reporting that their health status has improved as a result of their mindfulness practice. With the most common treatment that has been examined within the research literature is mindfulness-based stress reduction. And again, this has been developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn. It is the most well-studied, and it's typically conducted in group sessions, although individual sessions are also fine. I've done mindfulness with many individuals as well. And it's typically done in anywhere between 4 and 12 weekly sessions, either with a therapist who's trained in mindfulness or a psychologist who's trained in mindfulness, for example. And as I said before, it's been applied to many chronic health populations, including chronic pain, depression, anxiety, stroke, HIV. And mindfulness-based stress reduction incorporates three general meditation strategies. So it's the awareness of your breath, awareness of your body, and a mindful movement practice. So those three strategies, each week may focus on a different skill set. So you may focus on your breath for the first week. You may focus more on awareness of your body in the second week, et cetera, and learning different exercises that you can practice to increase your awareness of these various components. The second most common treatment is the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And this has been an iteration based on Aaron Beck's Cognitive Therapy for Depression. So we know that cognitive therapy for depression or cognitive behavioral therapy for depression is one of the most effective treatments we have for depression in MS, in the general population, across a lot of other chronic health populations as well. And the core goal of cognitive therapy is to identify any unhelpful or what we might say maladaptive patterns of thinking or behavior. So an example of this would be catastrophic thinking or always thinking in terms of extremes. So, you know, if one negative thing happens in your day, then the whole day has become terrible. Identifying how those automatic negative thoughts kind of impact our mood, impact the rest of our day, and overall contribute to clinical levels of depression. That's the main goal of cognitive therapy, is to identify what those unhelpful patterns of thinking are and then work to start to change or restructure those unhelpful thought patterns. So that's the primary mechanism by which we believe cognitive therapy for depression works. Now, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy works on those same principles. And then in addition to challenging or restructuring those unhelpful thought patterns, we use mindfulness strategies to prevent the relapse of depression. So we use mindfulness to try to focus on the present moment, for example, rather than ruminating about something that you did in the past or something in the past that upset you. And this has been shown to be very effective, both with MS and other disorders as well. And the third mindfulness-based treatment that I'll talk about today is the mindful movement practice. This is done in a variety of practices, including Tai Chi, Qigong, and Yoga. These are three, again, Eastern-influenced practices, each to have a slightly different focus, but generally work to reduce stress, enhance strength and flexibility, and improve mood, concentration, and relaxation. So the mindful movement, if you do practice yoga, you are likely already using mindfulness and may not even know it. So to get into the practical component of our exercise today, if you are interested in doing this with me, I invite you and welcome you to. If you'd like to take a break from the presentation, this will just be a few minutes. But let's start with getting into a comfortable sitting position or a reclined position, depending on where you are. And if you have your legs crossed, go ahead and uncross them. And try to loosen any tight clothing just so that you're completely comfortable. And I'd like you to place one hand on your chest and one hand on your abdomen. And I'd like you to take just three deep, relaxed breaths, counting to three for each inhale and three for each exhale. So I'll go ahead and count, and we can all do it together. Let's inhale one, two, three, and exhale one, two, three. One, two, three. One, two, three. What I want you to take notice of is if you find that your hand on your chest is moving more than the hand on your abdomen, as you breathe, I want you to focus on bringing the air deep into your abdomen so that the hand on your abdomen is moving more than the hand on your chest. It's a focus on getting a very deep breath. For some, it may be helpful to imagine a balloon that's sitting in your abdomen. And as you inhale, you want to fill up that balloon deep into your abdomen. Let's just take a few seconds to, again, do this breathing together. Go ahead and inhale one, two, three, and exhale one, two, three. One, two, three. One, two, three. This is the most basic mindfulness exercise, is being mindful to your breath. Practicing this on a daily basis can help overall just with stress reduction and can also help with sleep if you find that sleep disturbance is affecting your life. Doing this breathing exercise as you're trying to fall asleep can help relax your body, calm your mind, and help you initiate sleep. It can also be useful if you're having some tension or spasticity to reduce some of those sensations as well. With the interest of time, I won't go through the progressive muscle relaxation, which is our second exercise, but the general principle of our progressive muscle relaxation is that you start with the same principle of that mindful breath, and you do that for about 1 to 2 minutes. And then starting with your toes, I want you to curl your toes downward, hold that position for about 5 seconds, hold it really tight, and then relax those muscles and really focus on that sensation as your muscles start to relax. And then you'll work your way up, focusing on a different muscle group, going from your feet all the way up to your head. Again, these slides will be available after today's webinar, so you can go back to this slide, print it out, use it for yourself, and go through each muscle group, starting, you know, with your feet, going up through your legs, going up through your abdomen and your core, all the way up to some of the muscles in your face and your head. So again, these two exercises, they're usually my go-to as far as a general relaxation strategy, general mindfulness practice, just to get into a general relaxed state and awareness of the present moment. With that in mind, I do want to make sure we have plenty of time for questions today, so I will turn it back to our facilitator, and I'm happy to answer any questions about mindfulness that you may have today. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schaefer, Dr. Beyer, and Dr. Hughes, for providing a diverse look at research updates. So as Dr. Hughes mentioned, we are going to be moving into a Q&A section, and I'd like to turn the first question to Dr. Schaefer. Dr. Schaefer, do you have an idea of what the specific medical centers are that are doing stem cell clinical trials?
So, Laura, I noticed I've been looking over the questions, and I see that there are quite a few questions on various topics, one of them being what centers are doing them. You know, there are a number of centers in the United States and in Canada, and these are just some examples. Of Northwestern University has been working in hematopoietic stem cell. The work that I was talking about of replacing the oligodendrocytes by direct injections into the brain is being designed by a consortium of MS centers in New York, although that's all in the very early stages. University of Washington in the past has done these. In Canada, University of Ottawa, I believe McGill. I think that you can get a lot of information about these by going to, I'm going to give two sources. One of them is the National MS Society website, and that is nationalmssociety.org. And then /research, and you'll be able to find more information. Or the Canadian stem cell site, and the Stem Cell Foundation of .ca, that is the Canadian stem cell site, would give some more information about what sites are actually doing this.
And just to keep on the theme of clinical trials, are there any clinical trials being held right now for drugs for myelin repair?
I'm aware of some very small studies. I know there's been one at UCSF that's been going on for a while and may be completed, and with a very small number of patients using an antihistamine medication. There may be others. A lot of the information about clinical trials can be found at the NIH or at the National Institute of Health website. So clinical trials, I think it's clinicaltrials.gov. Anybody else know whether that's the correct site? I believe that it is.
I think it's clinicaltrials.gov, yeah.
Clinicaltrials.gov, and then you could put in remyelinating trials.
Perfect. I'm going to skip around a little bit and direct this next question to Dr. Beyer. And this is a basic question, Dr. Beyer, that always gets asked. Is it ever too late to begin an exercise program? If one starts 2 years into their diagnosis, is that okay?
Absolutely. It's never too late to start an exercise program. You can always receive benefit from doing exercise. So I would say it's never too late. Meet with your doctor, meet with a physical therapist, and see what kind of exercises they might recommend for you.
Terrific. Dr. Hughes, one of our participants asked, if the present experience is painful and negative, I would not want to focus on it. Can you explain how mindfulness can be used in this case?
Sure, and that's a great question that comes up so often, because when we label something as painful or negative, that's something that we're typically used to having a judgment label on things. But actually paying attention to the pain in the present moment or paying attention to that negative emotion, let's say it's sadness, for example, it actually changes the experience. And the way that most of our emotions or our sensations are meant to occur is they come and they go. And so if you start to notice that emotion and start to just focus on how it's affecting you, you may notice that it first increases and then decreases over time, kind of like a wave. And so when you're in a mindfulness exercise, particularly a longer one that could be 30 or 40 minutes long, the intensity of that pain you will see start to dissipate over time. And the more you can practice that, the less you'll be confined or ruled by the negativity of that. An alternative way of thinking about it could also be that as you notice the pain, you may also become more aware of more positive things in the present moment, just as a general compare and contrast. So again, if you're doing these exercises and you feel pain in your left arm, you may then change your focus to your right foot, which is not in pain. And so it really is about harnessing that power of attention and what your mind is drawn to.
Thank you, Dr. Hughes. Dr. Schaefer, we didn't talk about diet at all in regard to myelin repair, and one of our participants asked if diet does play a role in myelin repair.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Terrific. I'm going to ask you one more question since we have you here. One of our participants asked for clarification and the question is, does stem cell, has it only been tested on relapsing remittent MS, and has it not been tested in primary progressive MS?
I'm not aware of studies in primary progressive MS, which is not to say that there aren't some. I think that with all of the treatments for MS, it's clear that early treatment is going to bring better results than later treatment. And there were several questions that I saw that related to this. Is this only good for relapsing remitting, or does it work for progressive? And I mentioned that the one clinical trial that is actually going on right now of remyelination, the RENEW study, remyelination in optic neuritis, is very early treatment. It's when the optic neuritis is occurring, so immediately after the attack of giving this remyelinating antibody. So I think the longer the damage has been there, the greater the challenge to trying to repair it.
Okay, thank you so much. Dr. Beyer, for those in wheelchairs with no ability whatsoever to walk, what other avenues do you recommend?
There's many, many options for people who have decreased mobility or even are using wheelchairs for mobility. Things like hand cycling, there's adaptive yoga that can be done in a seated position. There's some strength training that can be done. Like I said earlier, I think even meeting with a physical therapist once can help help you figure out what would be the best exercises to do, and especially kind of figuring out what your goals are in terms of improved mobility.
Thank you, Dr. Beyer. Dr. Hughes, I know there's no typical MS patient, but how often do you typically recommend mindfulness exercises?
Another great question. I would say my most typical recommendation is about 5 minutes per day for the first week and finding a time that works best with your schedule. And then beyond that, you know, there's not really a recommended dosage or length, but you could break it up into multiple exercises per day. So if you're particularly stiff in the morning, for example, doing something in the morning could be helpful with getting the breathing going and the blood flow going. And then at night, if you're having difficulty sleeping, it can help kind of calm the body and prepare for sleep again. And then if you're experiencing stress throughout the day, again, it can be used as a stress reduction tool throughout the day. So I would say use it to where you feel like you need it most in the day.
Thank you, Dr. Hughes. I'm going to ask Dr. Schaefer one last question and then give Dr. Schaefer, Dr. Beyer, and Dr. Hughes a chance to give a conclusion before we end tonight's presentation. So, Dr. Schaefer, after destroying the immune system and rebuilding it, is the person then subject to diseases that he may have been immune to?
Well, that's one of the issues with all of our immune therapies and also with replacing the immune system. It's also true with many of the drugs that we use for relapsing-remitting MS, that there may be some ways in which this interferes with normal immune system function. So, you know, I don't think that one could make a general comment about all of these different lines of investigation, but that certainly is a consideration.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schaefer. Would you like to add anything before we conclude tonight's presentation?
I just see a question coming up about biotin, and biotin is another substance that is under investigation for whether it helps with myelin repair. And I believe that there are some credible studies being done with this. The problem is it's really quite expensive, that although one can buy it over the counter, to use it in doses that have been used in the clinical trials would cost in the range of $300 a month or so, which is a lot of money to spend, especially when we're very, very early stages of any certainty about whether it's actually helpful.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schaefer. Dr. Beyer, would you like to add anything before we conclude this evening?
You know, I also just noticed a question that came up asking about whether cognition can be tested. And while that wasn't the topic that I talked on, I just wanted to say that, yes, you can have cognition tested through a neuropsychologist or a speech-language pathologist or even an occupational therapist can do assessments. And so I think that would be a great option. Another person asked about options for adaptive sports. And there's one website actually I learned about this weekend called adaptiveadventures.org. And on their website, they have a number of different links for different organizations nationwide. So you might want to check out adaptiveadventures.org, which can help you get connected with other organizations which might be in your area for adaptive sports.
Thank you, Dr. Beyer. Dr. Hughes, would you like to add anything as we conclude tonight?
Sure, thank you. One thing I didn't add in my talk was also how mindfulness and meditation can be helpful for caregivers. So if we have family members and caregivers on the phone who are also experiencing stress, there has been a study specifically of mindfulness-based interventions for stress with caregiving, and there's also been benefits shown with that as well. So it's not just limited to patients. I think we can all benefit from some of the mindfulness practices.
And Dr. Hughes, thank you for that comment, because one thing that can do MS that we do focus on is the support partner as well as the person with MS. So thank you for adding that to the discussion. And as we continue to conclude tonight's program, I would like to inform you of some of the additional resources that you may find informative and helpful. On the CanDo MS website, mscandu.org, you will find archive webinars, e-news, and library articles, including an article written by Dr. Schaefer, Dr. Beyer, and Dr. Hughes. You can also submit a question to the Ask the Can-Do team, which will be answered by our team of MS Can-Do experts. In addition, the National MS Society publishes a wide range of literature, including literature on research directions in MS and a video on MS research. Please visit nationalmssociety.org for these and other resources provided by the National MS Society. And finally, the next presentation in our webinar and telelearning series will be on Tuesday, May 10th at the same time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Mind and Body, a Winning Team in Stress Management. We will look at the role researchers play. We do hope that you will tune in to that webinar. As always, you can register for the webinar and telelearning series free of charge on the CanDo MS website, mscando.org. And finally, for those participating live tonight, you will see a survey appear on your computer screen. We have a new survey format, so please take a moment to complete the survey and share your input. Your feedback helps us to continue to improve our webinar and telelearning series. You will also receive a PDF of tonight's slides by email. I do want to thank you and also thank our speakers tonight, Dr. Schaefer, Dr. Beyer, and Dr. Hughes. We very much appreciate your time and commitment to this presentation. And to all of our participants, thank you and have a great night.